From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, as Harley riders come to town this weekend, the number of motorcycle accidents in Wisconsin is on the rise. Later, how multilingualism is shaping the face of religion in Milwaukee.
Especially on Sunday mornings, to be able to worship in diverse languages helps people understand that we are all one family, no matter where we come from, what languages we speak, or what cultures we say we are from.
We'll hear about a historical spy novel set in the Civil War, and a Milwaukee musician melds jazz and hip-hop into a sound he hopes is classic.
I feel like what I'm bringing that isn't really being brought is a certain lightheartedness, even if I'm touching on darker subjects or just like really serious, like human emotions.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Glad to have you listening today. Tens of thousands of motorcycle riders are already in Milwaukee for Harley-Davidson's 110th anniversary celebration, and tens of thousands more will be rolling into town by the weekend. But riders of all brands of motorcycles are noting with some alarm that accidents involving motorcycles are on the rise in Wisconsin, and now some are calling for an event next summer to raise awareness. Eric Oliver covered the story for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he's with us to fill in the details. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
How common are accidents involving motorcycles in Wisconsin?
They're shockingly on the rise. In the last couple of years, they've been on the rise, and the deaths because of them are also increasing because of the increased amount of accidents.
How significant is the increase? What kinds of numbers are we talking about?
I mean, just from 2011 to 2012, there were 2,574 accidents in 11, and then in 12, there were 2,837. So, I mean, it's a pretty drastic increase, and the numbers this year are looking astronomical from what they have so far.
Now, you spoke with the director of the Wisconsin Motorcycle Safety Program.
Yes,
first
sir.
Of all, what is that program?
It's just a program which we're trying to get a motorist aware of people on bikes, riders. I feel like the biggest problem with this is the people in the cars don't see the people on the bikes, and that's a big problem. So we're trying to raise the awareness of just the riders.
And this is this actually operated by the state, or this is an independent program?
Yeah, it's operated by the state.
You spoke, as I said, with the director of that program. What is his take on the frequency of accidents involving motorcycles here? Is he willing to ascribe blame one way or the other? Is this a two-way street, if you will?
Yeah, he's saying it is a two-way street. He thinks that older riders are the ones that are getting in more accidents because they're not as comfortable with the bikes and they aren't as aware as the new riders are. But at the same time, he also thinks the blame is on people in cars not paying as much attention as just the people on the bikes are. He says that he doesn't believe how many cars just get over and merge without ever looking, and that's a big problem when you're on two wheels.
Well, and I want to go back to that point you just made, though, the difference between older riders and younger riders. That's something I don't know that a lot of people have considered. Is this just a question of older riders not used to the firepower, if you will, of the newer bikes?
What he's saying is that the older riders, they got comfortable on the bikes they had, that when they switch over to new bikes, they aren't as comfortable on them and riding them like they have ridden their whole lives, and they're not getting any additional training, which is a big problem.
Well, and so you said the number of accidents is going up. Does that mean the number of deaths is going up as well?
I mean, they're not correlated. Because there's an increase in accidents doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get an increase in deaths. And that's evident in 2011, 2012. There was less accidents in 11 but more deaths, and more accidents in 12 but less deaths. So I feel like it's really just, I mean, not to say it's a crapshoot, but it's a crapshoot.
Well, and you do note, though, how helmets play into the injury and death equation. What data do you have on how wearing helmets has been affecting the number of deaths?
On the helmets, we have that in 2011, I think it was some 93% of all the deaths were because riders didn't have their helmets on. And in 2012, that number dropped to about 77%. So, I mean, that's a very drastic number, in my opinion. But it's always known that wearing a helmet is going to be what saves your life.
Well, and you said the deaths were caused by it. We should note that we don't necessarily have the data to prove that every one of those deaths was caused because the rider wasn't wearing a helmet.
Yeah, we don't have that data.
Well, so there's this drive now to hold an awareness day in 2014. Who is organizing that drive?
That's Vanetta Dawson and Tracy Dent. Tracy Dent's a local activist, and then Vanetta is the sister of Venancia, the person they're hoping to dedicate the drive to.
Well, and so why these two?
Well, Tracy Dent was at a memorial for Venancia, and he was just really touched because he heard a bunch of bikers saying that there wasn't anything like this. They didn't have a day to increase motorcycle awareness, and they needed something to be done because the problem is getting out of hand.
Tell me about the death that sparked this.
Well, Venancia was a community member. She was highly active in the community. She had her own store, and she was very, very active in just trying to touch everyone's lives. She got the nickname Miss Feisty, actually, because she stood up for like people who didn't have a voice and such. And because of it, they really wanted to just commemorate her because it was a shame that she died.
Well, and so who are the supporters of this awareness day? Who are they petitioning? Who would need to make this happen?
Well, they're all petitioning bikers right now, and they're really just petitioning people who were touched by Venancia as well just to get their support out there. But it's really the bikers they're going for because the people on the bikes are the ones that are at danger.
Who has to declare the day next year as an awareness day?
They're hoping to do a partnership with the city of Milwaukee, and they're hoping somehow that Harley Davidson will get involved just because Harley has a reach that's incredible in Milwaukee, and if they can get involved, they can get bikers from all over the world involved.
Well, and so what form are they hoping an awareness day would take? What do they hope would happen on this day?
What they're hoping is they want to sort of do a weekend festival over at State Fair Park where they're going to have motorcycle awareness day, like events, like activities to increase motorcycle awareness, and then
bands and I know that they already have safety classes that go on there,
right? Yeah, they have safety classes there that go.
Well, and so, yeah, they're hoping a couple of days, and the idea would be to attract motorcyclists to go and learn to ride their bikes more safely?
Yeah, they're hoping to have motorcyclists out there. They're trying to do events that are going to increase motorcycle safety as well as promote fun, like having a couple concerts and food to gain profits for the city.
Well, none of the people – I thought it was interesting. None of the people you quote in this article is calling for mandatory helmet laws as part of this. So what are the safety precautions they're talking about?
They just really want to make people more aware that bikes are on the road and that we have to look out for them because they obviously can't swerve and change lanes as easily as we can.
You quote one person who used an acronym. I think it was C-S-E-E.
Yeah.
So what do those initials in that acronym stand for?
All right, well, C stands for search, evaluate, and execute. And what that means is that you want to search your surroundings, you want to evaluate how you're going to shift positions, change lanes, change speed, and then you're going to execute and go ahead and do that to avoid other cars.
What got you interested in the story in the first place? Why was this your assignment?
I started writing last year, and I love it. I really love to get out there anytime I can, and I just love my bike with a passion.
Does it give you pause to hear about, as you did the reporting for this, how many accidents are occurring involving motorcycles on Wisconsin roads and the increase in them?
Yeah, it's really unnerving because, I mean, I've been on my bike for a while, so I've seen cars just ignore me and swerve in front of me. And it's a little scary because, I mean, if I slide, I'm going to – there's nothing stopping me from meeting the pavement, and I don't want to meet the pavement.
When you learn to drive a car, people talk about defensive driving. Is the same holding true for you riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I ride very defensively. I'm always paying attention to my surroundings, and I'm never – ever trying to get distracted. Like, I don't have music on my bike, which I think is a big thing, so I could always just pay attention to what's around me.
Do you wear a helmet?
I do wear a helmet.
What is it about the motorcycle experience that, I mean, we have tens and hundreds of thousands of Harley riders that are in town this weekend. What is it that attracts you to being on a bike?
I just love the freedom. I mean, it's a different experience than being in a car. You have four doors surrounding you. You have, you're safe and enclosed in your car. On your bike, it's just a whole different experience. You get that thrill, the rush of adrenaline. It's like nothing I can compare to.
You've had close calls, though?
I've had a couple. I mean, nothing like I'm going to get hit by a bike and slide on the ground. But there was one where a guy just cut me off, and it was probably the scariest thing because it was only about my fourth month on the bike. So I wasn't as ready, but I avoided them and I didn't get hit, so that was a godsend.
Did you take a safety course?
I did take a safety course,
and it was important to you?
Yeah, it was important because I had never ridden a bike before, so I had to get the basics down there, and then I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to get hit by any cars anytime soon.
Eric Oliver, thanks so much, and stay safe out there.
Thank you.
Eric Oliver is a reporter for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. There's a link to his article about motorcycle safety issues from WUWM.com/lake effect. A short break now, but when we come back, how multiculturalism is finding its way into the pews of Milwaukee churches. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The days of the Catholic Mass in Latin are pretty much over. Some Catholics still worship in the old style, but most pray in their native languages. In the U.S., some parishes even offer multilingual, multicultural masses to bring together various communities. To learn how this impacts the connections people have to their faith and each other, Lake Effect's Amy Kiley visited a local Catholic church comprised largely of immigrants.
Parishioners of St. Michael's Catholic Church on Milwaukee's north side worship in six languages. When they say the Lord's Prayer during the all-parish Mass, they speak those languages at the same time. To believers, such a linguistic cacophony might bring to mind the story of the church's birth at Pentecost. That's when the Bible says the Holy Spirit descended upon the disciples of Jesus and inspired them to preach in the languages of everyone listening. The colloquial Greek of those early Christians survived in the Kyrie, a prayer for God's mercy. Otherwise, Latin became the official language of the Catholic Church, and worship became monolingual. St. Michael's reflects how the use of language has evolved in the U.S. Catholic Church. Founded in the 19th century, the parish's first language of worship was Latin. In the 1960s, Catholic leaders declared the faithful could celebrate Mass in their native languages. That's around the time Maria Sommerauer came to St. Michael's from Germany. She was 29 years old and alone in a new country.
When I came here, they said there was a German Mass. It's just if you went abroad and you could have a Mass in English, it sort of comes from your heart.
Sommerauer remembers when Sunday attendance at St. Michael's dwindled to about 50 people. Milwaukee's German roots were fading. St. Michael's was about to close.
Then the Hispanics came around, and then the monk came around, and they had gone to other churches that said, we can't handle these languages. So they sent them away, and they came to St. Michael's, and then the church was full.
One person who helped fill the church was Maihua Moa, an ethnic Hmong from Laos. Her people came to Wisconsin in large numbers after helping the U.S. during the Vietnam War. Moa was seven at the time, but it wasn't until 1991 that she and her husband joined St. Michael's. She says she loves attending Mass in both English and Hmong.
To understand it in both languages helps me understand myself more fully and practice my faith, and to be able to continue to pass that on to my children.
The diversity of St. Michael's reflects that of the modern U.S. and its Catholics. Census data shows Asians are the fastest-growing demographic group, outpacing even Hispanics. To accommodate Catholic immigrants, the U.S. bishops have released a document called Guidelines for Intercultural Competence in Ministry. They've also called for unity in diversity during worship. Now, numerous American parishes hold multilingual, multicultural masses. St. Michael's has regular services in Spanish and English with an all-parish Mass once a month.
Especially on Sunday mornings, to be able to worship in diverse languages helps people understand that we are all one family. No matter where we come from, what languages we speak, or what cultures we say we are from, here at St. Michael's, everybody just seemed to be one big family.
Just as the German-Americans of St. Michael's welcomed the Hmong, Lao, and Hispanics, those immigrants are now welcoming ethnic Karen and Karenee refugees from Myanmar. Moa's husband, Zong Chen, says the parish offers the gift of empathy to refugees.
We had the same experience, so we don't know where to turn to, we don't know where the helps are, we don't know where to go. But now we've been through that, so we can at least show them this is what you need to do to survive in this culture, this new land, a new country.
The Moas run a consulting firm that provides language services and cultural insight. Their three adult children are native English speakers, but they still pray in Hmong. Parishes like St. Michael's could become the norm in the U.S. Experts predict minorities will be the majority here by 2043. Perhaps that will bring the U.S. Catholic Church full circle. Perhaps soon more parishes will sound like St. Michael's and like the disciples at Pentecost. For Lake Effect, I'm Amy Kiley.
The music we heard at the beginning of Amy's piece is from Anonymous Four. It's Ave Maria o Autrix Vitae from 12th century composer and nun Hildegard von Bingen. A link to the full chant and its translation is at wuwm.com/lake effect. Also on the website, you can hear the congregation of St. Michael's saying the Our Father in six languages. Our Civil War contributor turns to historical fiction in a new novel. We'll get the story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The spring of 1862 marked a ratcheting of Civil War tensions between the Union capital, Washington, and the Confederate seat of power in Richmond, just to the south. Union General George McClellan failed to take Richmond in the summer, which allowed the war to continue for years. That battle also preceded one of the most memorable showdowns of the early Civil War, the Second Battle of Bull Run, on this date in 1862, at which Wisconsin soldiers fought bravely. Meanwhile, real-life spies from both the North and the South were working against each other. A recent novel tells the tale of one of those subversive plots, and it's up to a young Union lieutenant and a grizzled New York journalist to stop it. Richmond's Bloody Road is written by Milwaukee author Thomas Martin Saturday, or as Lake Effect listeners might know him, Thomas Martin Sobotke, the voice of our Civil War series. Sobotke tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce why he turned to fiction.
At one point, I decided I wanted to have our characters in the first novel uncover two Confederate double agents who worked out of Richmond. And I was digging around for background in some books about Union intelligence and found there were two Confederate double agents that were found out. So the facts of history actually met fiction 100% dead on. And that kind of staggered me. So I have to be careful that I don't, in creating a fictional story, run into real history too much.
Well, tell us where we are, at what point in the war we are at the beginning of Richmond's Bloody Road.
Yeah, this is just before the Union Army of the Potomac with George McClellan is finally going to move out of Washington, D.C., over 100,000 men. It's March of 1862. In the West, there is some success going on with Grant at Fort Donelson and, you know, and so on. And Shiloh's weeks away. But in the East, things have not been going well at all. And McClellan has done really nothing. And All Quiet on the Potomac becomes a hit song because they're not doing much. And then, of course, the two characters that are the prime characters in what will be a series of novels meet in rather unusual circumstances.
Well, let's talk about your two protagonists. I want to start with Benjamin Eaton. Did you want to make him representative of your average Union soldier? Or was he kind of a composite of a few different figures you had in mind or totally made out of whole cloth?
He would be a composite, but he was I wanted to have a young officer who would be with one of the classes of 1861 at West Point, who either were thrown right out into the Army into a great war, you know, right as soon as they graduated, or had their last year cut short and were sent out there. And Eaton's character is really that stoic character where he's always going to do his duty. He really is fearless for his life. Devoted to the Union all the way, but he has an unusual background. His family's really from Tidewater, Maryland, right across the Potomac from Virginia. And in his grandfather's generation, they owned some slaves. And his manner of speech is a Virginia drawl. And in fact, the rest of his family is in Fairfax County across the Potomac. And they are slaveholders still. And there's been an estrangement. And he constantly has to fight with people who think somehow he shouldn't be in the Union Army because he sounds so Southern and he's wearing blue. And he is in the regular artillery. He's a regular, and he's commanding that little bit of the regular United States Army that existed at the beginning of the Civil War, not volunteers. So he's a thoroughgoing professional, and he has this place within him, though, is a great weakness, just like any great character would in a Greek tragedy almost. And that is that at Henry House Hill, he was with his battery as a lieutenant, and all six guns were historically taken. They were Ricketts' battery. And he had a horrible experience in that battle, and it shakes him to the core, and he's fighting in command of Union troops in any battle with that memory. It just, you know, these recurring dreams and the savagery of it all. And it's something he has to overcome. But otherwise, he's that stock character that reins in my other character somehow.
Speaking of reining in other characters, I believe that would apply most appropriately to Sanford Ellis. He is a reporter out of New York. I know you just had an article published on war correspondence. How much did you draw on that for modeling this character, Sanford Ellis?
Well, I've studied a great deal about the war correspondence in the Civil War. I certainly did model Sanford Ellis after, again, a composite of a lot of reporters. I just made him more irresponsible than most. That's part of the problem. He's from Boston, and he's a Boston Brahmin, Harvard-educated, lives on Beacon Street, on Beacon Hill. He drops names all over the place. He is a thoroughgoing womanizer, a cad of the worst type.
And a drunk.
And a drunk, yes. He likes alcohol, and he gets drunk when he has not a whole lot to do. It's odd. He ended up going to work for the New York Herald newspaper, and he is a thoroughgoing unionist, but he's also an abolitionist. And the New York Herald is Tammany Hall Democrat and very sympathetic to the Southern situation. And one of the fascinating things is that here he's working for a newspaper that is completely opposite editorially from what he believes. But he explains early in the book that, well, he was looking for some sort of job, and that was the one that was open at the time.
So how did these two characters from such different parts of the country with such different attitudes and kind of personalities, how did they get thrown together?
Well, they're both in the same Washington, D.C. bordello at the same time. That's pretty much it. A place called Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies.
Uh-huh.
But the education that these women have is distinctly, shall we say, illegal. Of course, this is a place full of cigar smoke, clanking glasses, and it's just a wild place. There were hundreds of these bordellos that sprang up in Washington as soon as the Civil War began. I know it's rather scandalous. Most people don't want to talk about that, but that would be the truth. And in fact, 13th and D Streets was about the worst neighborhood for these things. And today, I believe the Smithsonian Institution has taken over that property, if I'm not mistaken. So that's kind of, if you're walking through some of the newer parts of the Smithsonian, you may be walking over my fictional Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies. But they have a fight. They literally get to it. And one of the things that staggers Ellis is that this young artillery lieutenant is able to get him up against a wall with his hand on his throat, and in a position where this little much smaller lieutenant, you know, he didn't think this guy has this kind of a starch behind him. And they both kind of have a truce and decide that it's not worth the fighting over. And they leave the bordello only to hear the barking of a dog from in back.
And that's when they discover this dead body right near the restrooms, if you will.
That's right. Out on the woodpile is a man in a black frock coat who is obviously dead. And as the body is being examined by Sanford Ellis, Ellis tells him that he's done a lot of what's called night work. Apparently before the war, as a reporter, they stuck him on the police beat, which a paper like the New York Herald really made its money as a tabloid almost. They liked to cover murders and all kinds of seamy underbelly kind of stories for New York City. So he's had a lot of experience actually running down murders and many other things, and he's worked with what sad excuses there were in those days for police departments. And he is a bit of a sleuth.
Now, as we follow these two characters as they're investigating this murder and finding out that it has more and more to do with the Confederate cause, we meet a series of characters that at first present themselves as the complete opposite of what they end up being. And I'm immediately thinking of Sarah.
Sarah is apparently to Eaton's command. They come in the dark while they're in the Virginia Peninsula later in that year when the army has moved and is trying to capture Richmond in the summer of 1862. And Sarah has brought a little boy to freedom, but she has a message for any Union unit she can find that is rather startling. But I had an awareness that I wanted to have some African-American characters that during the war were doing a lot more on their own initiative, which would have been actually for at least a portion of the African-American community in Richmond. True, there were African-Americans who were aiding the Union as the war developed. There were those who were running away. But there was also a group of free blacks in Richmond who, although they were considered inferior to any white person, were carving out niches for themselves. And I wanted these characters to have the abilities and initiative and having a sense of their own identities that would really run counter to what people would assume slaves would be.
Now, Sarah helps bring Ellis and Eaton into the company of the Dandridge sisters, and I want to have you talk a little bit about these characters and what role they end up playing in this mystery that they're trying to solve.
Sarah's been sent out to find them because these two Richmond Confederate ladies want to help the Union cause. And of course, our two main characters, when they meet the Dandridge sisters, find that they're both under 30, both extremely attractive. And they're especially drawn to Elizabeth Dandridge, who runs counter to a lot of things that would be a Confederate lady of Richmond at that time. I really got onto the Dandridge sisters from history. There was a real person named Elizabeth Van Loo, who gave enormous amounts of intelligence through the lines to the Union side as the war progressed. She was actually living in a mansion on Grace Street in Richmond. That's where I have their mansion with her mother. But I just changed that and I made the other person a sibling. And I guess you're trying to figure out, well, how would these women hide their Union proclivities? And of course, what they do is that Elizabeth, the way she does it is that she is such a feminist, such a suffragist, that and so independent and fierce that a lot of the gentlemen of Richmond who would want to marry such a beautiful woman just, you know, can't stand her. And so that's her way of doing it. Jenny hides her Union proclivities by being the opposite of her sister, so conventional. But she has an illness, you know, that limits her marriage prospects. And they do have a heart, these women. They are very strong in collecting money for Confederate soldiers who are wounded. And that's a real humanitarian thing that they sincerely are devoted to. The way Elizabeth Van Loo stayed out of trouble was she also cultivated an image. She was like the Dandridges. She did help any Union prisoners as well as Confederate men who were ill. But she was known as something like Crazy Mary. She kind of acted a little strange in public. And so if she had said something or done something that might look like she was disloyal, people actually put it off to, well, she's nuts. Don't worry about it. And she actually got through a lot of it, particularly at the end of the war, with that reputation.
Were there spies who actually were able to get behind the lines at Richmond to be on the Confederate side, Union spies like Ellis and Eaton end up pretty much becoming?
Yes, there were spies on both sides getting into Washington. I think the infiltration of our nation's capital on the Union side, Washington, D.C., was a lot more extensive. The Confederates were much more successful because that city, Washington, was really just across the Potomac from Virginia. And most people that lived in Washington all through the war were born and bred Southerners. And in fact, John Hay, Lincoln's secretary, noted in his diary that any time a Union defeat was announced, you would hear Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag on pianos up and down the streets of Washington as hundreds, if not thousands, of Washingtonians celebrated every Confederate victory. So if you're Abraham Lincoln or you're anybody in Washington on the Union side, you become aware very quickly of the fact that the enemy is in your midst. And how many of those people who are openly celebrating Union defeats would be excellent choices for espionage, and there were many.
Well, so what's next for Ellis and Eaton?
Well, my next novel is entitled The Lamentations of Uriah. This is a continuation of this problem with General McClellan and certain generals around him. And if the first novel had a secret or piece of information that could turn the direction of the war, this will be dwarfed by what appears in the second novel. And much to my surprise, when I did the historical background research I wanted to do, it actually fits my novel plot that I put together that I thought was so wild and crazy. And really what it is, it's taking what really was the case and just turning it up that one little slight notch further than historically was true. It's real close to what could have happened.
Well, Thomas Martin Sabaki, thanks for coming in and sharing Richmond's Bloody Road with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thomas Martin Saturday's first historical novel in the Ellis Eaton series is Richmond's Bloody Road, published by Moving Train Books. The second book will be published in the coming months. Saturday is the pen name of our own Civil War correspondent, Thomas Martin Sabatke. You can listen to the series of Civil War conversations with him at WUWM.com. One last break, and then we'll talk with a Milwaukee musician who is fusing his loves for jazz and hip-hop. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Right now, give me that. Now, I need it right now, give me that. Now, I need it right now. Now put your hands up in the air.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee is not the center of the hip-hop universe, but one local artist is setting out to make a name for himself and his jazz-steeped hip-hop music, right here. Classic, that's with K's at the beginning and the end, put out his first album last fall.
High speed, high speed, yours like a rotary dial, and that's what you're not turning. Chefing in the kitchen while you're leaving pots burning. Why you're not earning? Why the heck I'm steady cake? What up? What up? I go for my point, bling, bang, boom, pie out. You never cut my light out. Better correct yourself like Whiteout coming right out of the gates with a straight up. Kill flow. You had enough? Give me some
a long set of live shows wrapped up recently, and he had a chance to swing by the Lake Effect studio to chat with our Nathan Royster. Classic explained how he defines his own brand of hip-hop.
Symphonic rap and soul. That was a title given by, when I first put out the album, one of the reviewers, they like coined this term. They were like, it's like symphonic rap and soul. And I was like, you know what? You're right. So, and I think that just kind of most appropriately describes it and kind of encompasses everything of kind of what I'm trying to go for as far as sound, because I want it to be a wide range of sounds, so much so that it just becomes kind of one sound, you know, to be truly a classic sound. So it's symphonic. There's a lot of strings. I do a lot of string arrangements and piano and heavy theory. Not super heavy, but I mean, I took classical theory. I took jazz theory. I'm a jazz kid. I went to art schools all throughout. So, like, that's heavily ingrained in me. It's super jazzy, but I feel like that plays into, like, the whole soul part because, like, I kind of can put, like, R&B, jazz all kind of into, like, a soul kind of thing. And then the rap part is, obviously, because I'm rapping. So, yeah, I want it to be a wide range.
You said you started making music when you were in 8th grade?
As far as, like, production work and, like, doing beats and stuff. But I started with music and playing sax in 4th grade. So I was a jazz kid from the age of 11 until present day.
You said you started producing first. Do you consider yourself more so a singer, vocalist, or a producer?
That's a good question. You know, sometimes that changes day to day. But I think what I'm going for now is just performer. And, like, just artists. So I think I've finally come to a comfortable medium where it's like, oh, like, I think my raps are actually kind of good now. Like, when I first started, I didn't think they were, I mean, I was hanging around, like, a lot of really talented, like, poets, true hip-hop heads. I wasn't really raised like that. Like, I was raised with, like, Tchaikovsky and Motown and Prince and Michael Jackson. So, like, I had some hip-hop, you know, ingrained early on. It wasn't, like, in heavy rotation. So, like, it wasn't until after I kind of got into the beat scene and was doing that for some years and started hanging around people. I was like, hey, I could do it. And then it wasn't until, like, this album that I was like, okay, maybe there is something to it. Like, maybe I actually am pretty decent at this.
Can I ask what your first rap was?
My first verse that I ever wrote is on the album. On a song called Not What You're Used To. I spit that verse to a very good friend of mine, Def C, who's from Chicago. And at the time, I was going to Madison, and I was doing beats and stuff. And, like, I was doing some beats for him. And we were just chilling in his dorm room. And I was like, hey, I have this verse. And I was like, I just want to know what you think of it. I've never really rapped. I just want to see, because I've just been around it. And he was like, I got done. And he was like, we should do an album. We should do something. I was like, what? You mean you want me to make you some beats? And he's like, no, like, you should rap on it. Like, we should make an album.
Well, what kind of importance do you put on the lyrics then?
I think subconsciously I put a lot of effort into it, but it's not like a really contrived, it's not like a concentrated effort as I'm writing it. I typically don't write anything down. I kind of just let, like, whatever song I'm writing to usually just means me listening to the same song for, like, an entire day, like, on repeat, like, at work, at home. And I just start muttering things and I just start writing. And then depending on kind of the story or the mood that I'm kind of getting from the track, kind of dictates where I go. And then from there, then I'm like, okay, speak like yourself, but make it rhyme. Because, like, I'm pretty, like, sarcastic and, like, humorous at most times. So I like to convey a lot of that wit and that intelligence in a way that's still melodic. So the lyrics are very important, but I'm probably one of the only rappers that would tell you that, like, that's not the first thing. Like, I don't sit there like, I gotta have this metaphor right here. A lot of my stuff is just, like, stories. It's just, like, me telling my story, like, a day in the life. Like, oh, yeah, this is how I feel when I drop out of school and then I have, like, negative $500 in my bank account.
Well, and the mainstream stigma is that you've got to rap about, like, your Ashton Martin or,
yeah,
you know.
I don't have one of those yet. I mean, if I did have one, I might. I wouldn't rap about it often, but I probably would, like, I throw something in there.
Yeah, I mean,
you gotta throw at least. I have to do at least one rapper thing, like, you know, just real quick, like Aston Martin.
Well, in that case, do you feel like you bring something to rap that maybe some other rappers or hip hop artists don't?
Absolutely, not even like in a super spiritual philosophical way, but I feel like I'm being kind of guided along this path by like this light. And I feel part of it is just this connection that I have with, like, some family members that I lost early on. I grew up with a very, like, artistic and very, like, gifted group of friends and family. And a lot of my family still to this day are, especially musicians-wise, so I was just kind of raised around it. So I kind of feel like I have a purpose now. And when you feel like you have a purpose, it kind of drives you and pushes you to do more and more and more. So I feel like what I'm bringing that isn't really being brought is a certain lightheartedness, even if I'm touching on darker subjects or just like really serious, like human emotions. It's still I use melody to kind of, even when it's something really dark, like, oh man, I'm just super depressed, I don't know what to do, blah, 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 blah. It's still like these really kind of haunting, beautiful harmonies that I use to tell it. So finding the beauty in the most hideous of things is kind of my job. I just want to put like a really positive spin, but without being like not poppy and not, you know, super contrived and super like, I'm trying to be positive and I'm trying to change your life and I want you to do this. Like, I'm not preaching. I'm not telling people what to do. I'm just, it's therapeutic for me. It makes me feel good.
Well, I think it's like how you were saying early on that you want to bring kind of a happiness or joy to even like sadder emotions. And mm-hmm. before you were talking about how you're really into, you know, Prince.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like Prince does that really well too.
Yeah.
I can kind of see that in just taking the most terrible breakup and making this song that you want to just dance to.
Mm-hmm.
Anything is like that,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. Could you perform that for us?
No? Yeah, sure thing. Hello. Don't even think about it. Do almost anything that you want me to do, yeah. But do almost any. True story. Do almost anything that you want me to do, yeah. But that really make you with it. Like me, like me, like me, anything like. See, you know that I would do almost anything that you want me to do, yeah. But hey, 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 K, L, A, double S, hey. See, I could take you to the moon or we could go to Saturn's rings. It's what you wanted me to do, yeah. But would that really make you mess with a guy like me? Like me, like me, anything like me. See, you know that I would do almost anything that you want me to do, yeah. But maybe it's best if you're not stuck with a guy like me. Like me, like me, anything like me. Let me grab this drink, let me take a sip. Cause this right here might take a bit. Not quite sure what the make of this, know what we making this. Chance that love or just taking risks. Cause I ain't really getting playing games and that's dangerous. Are you the 91 MJ and whoa, quit playing with. Me ain't never plan on staying in. Situation more than a day or 10. Used to have a heart but it came and went. The blame is in. That empty bottle of Cabernet up on the nightstand. And now I dream forever in every single one nightstand. You see we might stand a chance up in this crazy, crazy world. But with me behind the wheel I drive you crazy, crazy girl. Hazy swirls of smoke and empty black label bottles. What's on the table? Models. Every single time I pray she hollow is the word I fear. Got a lot of love to give, but I'm not looking for the one. My dear Sherry, you're more. I care much more than I could ever let you know. So before we slip and fall in love, I think I'll let you go. Clean up and out for. You got my body, now you want my soul. Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. See, I could take you to the moon or we could go to Saturn's ring. It's what you wanted me to do, yeah. But would that really make you what? With a guy like me, like me, like me, anything like me. See, you know that I would do almost anything that you wanted me to do, yeah. But maybe it's best if you're not stuck with a guy like me, like me, like me, anything like me, like me, like me, like me, like me, anything like me, like me, like me, anything like me, anything, anything like me, like me, like me, like me, like me, like me, anything like me, like me, like me, anything like me, please, please. Let me apologize if it seems that I'm just another lonely stoner who's too caught up in his dreams. And though I'm caught in this machine, I've done some dirt and still come clean. Some things I'm not too proud of, cause some tears, some screams and shouted. Now I'm out of what to give. Please don't try your luck with this. You don't really want to be stuck with this. And now when Cupid comes around, I'll be ducking quick. Believe I'm nothing without all of this pain and ugliness. And you're just too damn gorgeous to eat and put you up on this. So it's gonna take some adjustments. But it would be unjust if I did you this injustice and told you I could love again.
I'm sure it'll happen one day, but baby girl, right now I'm living that life. You're living that life, means you're living that right. When you're living that right, somebody gets left. Almost anything that you want me to do, yeah. It's best if you're not stuck with a guy like me. No, there'll never ever be anything like me. No, there'll never ever be, never be anything like me. No, there'll never ever be anything like me. Know that I would just do almost anything. You got my body, now you want my soul. Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it.
I love the video for anything. You have Xavier Ruffin do that. Did you two collaborate on what the story was going to be, or did he have complete control of all the video aspects of it?
The video aspect was all him. I mean, the success of that video and just how well it came off and the storyline was just all him. And it's a funny story, actually, really quick story. So two of the songs that I just did today, Forever Whatever and Anything, I was in the studio getting ready to record Anything. So I had just literally written it like a couple of days before that, fresh off of like, oh, she's going to London. I'm heartbroken. I got to do this song. And we were meeting up to discuss a video for Forever Whatever already because the album had already come out. And so he met me at the studio. And he sat in on the session for Anything, and literally I recorded the song. I came out of the booth. He was like, I have an idea for a video. Like, we're going to shoot this video too. So we came there just to talk about one video, and he was just kind of taken by the track and had this whole idea for like, all right, so it kind of has this vibe of this breakup. So like, what if you like set up this elaborate dinner? And he like started breaking it down for me and was telling me how it was going to happen, and walking my girlfriend up to like this romantic dinner, and we're like walking up, she's like, oh my god, I'm so excited. And we go in, and then eventually she finds out, and once I hit play, I have like these speakers set up in this nice long table with a bottle of wine. Essentially I proceed to break up with her via this song.
The video for Forever Whatever, you're dancing and singing and like smashing a piano over near it. It looks like you kind of cut it cleverly to look like it's being smashed near the Calatrava and the War Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
How important is Milwaukee for you and your music?
More than I can even tell people. I try to all the time. And when I was speaking earlier on how I really feel like I have a purpose, one of my greatest purposes, I feel like, besides filling this legacy of like my father and like my family and my friends and those who have believed in me up to this point, is the city itself. Because I love the city that I come from. I have my qualms with it just as much as anybody would have. Take it to heart, like if I go to shows and like I do a lot of call and response and I try and get people involved, and like most people, it's just kind of natural to just start moving. But when I see those people that aren't and they're just like too cool, and I'm just like, dude, I'm doing this for you. Like, I'm here for you. And it frustrates me because you all have supported me so much to this point and believed in me at many points when I didn't. And so now here I am, like, showing that this is a worthwhile investment of your time. And so I'm kind of fighting with that of like not trying not to take it so personally, but I guess I don't know if it's just like an artist thing. And I mean, I guess it's pushing me and kind of driving me to do more and create more. But the city is very important to me, to the point that I got it tattooed on my hand, so my microphone hand, so that when I go to other cities and when I go to other states, I can see that like this came from Milwaukee. And that's what I want. I want to be like that thing, like that came from Milwaukee. Like, you know, like these big stars and these big names that kind of personify a city. I tell people I want to be famous because I want to have access to the most amount of ears, not just to because so I can be on TMZ or like I don't.
I would love to see why you're on TMZ. I'm not sure why.
But I mean, I want to do it because, I want to take the name of the city and the name that I'm trying to make for myself and what I'm representing and what I feel like is out there and can really just make a difference, not to get all corny, but like really kind of make a difference in people's just mindsets. And just fighting ignorance is one of my biggest goals. And I think that with the positivity and the light thing, if I was famous and I could do that and still do what I'm doing now, like people would, it would just make people feel better, which would just make me feel better, and everyone would be all happy and whatnot for the most part.
But then you'd have nothing to sing about if everything was happy.
No, I mean, I'm sure my life would still suck, you know. That's just that's just the way it works.
Well, Classic, thank you for being on Lake Effect today.
Thank you for having me.
Classic is a Milwaukee-based hip-hop artist. He chatted with Nathan Royster and left us with the track Forever Whatever off of his first album called In the Making. That's all for the Thursday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 o'clock for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
And if you ain't know, then I bet that you know. And now, yeah, I'm down. It's forever. Sitting at work with my late registration to the whackness. I have no relation. Wanna see hope is a demonstration. I'ma be dope. Play me on your station. Patiently waiting for my chance to rock the nation. On a Star Trek, just to rock a space station. Pressing all these square buttons, cut it PlayStation. You take away the hate. In try appreciation for real deals, with the other words like fountain, take a hike, mountain, pedal bikes, never right, feels wrong, came to fall on for me to die in songs. So tell me on to the tracks, freight train coming when I'm humming in the boot. Put a claw to these Penelope pit stops, so when they hit stop, skinny kids stay smiling like Chris Rock. Tick tock, time's up like a ghost stealing wristwatches. And you know I'm on my hip hop, but you know I'm on a hip hop. Is